Look at you. You've been really inspired to participate in more local politics. You're killing it.
What has your councilperson done for you lately?
Don't listen to her. Look how far you've come. This anti-LGBTQ bill was stopped with your help.
Ha! That's not even mentioning the federal government. Cheeto in chief and his cronies don't give a damn about you. Neither did the other so-called leaders of the free world. That's why your community is still struggling. Never forget, you were dragged to this brutal land against your will.
Your ancestors didn't fight so hard for nothing. They're the reason you're alive today. You may be tired, but you've made hella gains. You're on the come up. You're making oppressive systems crumble, sis.
No. She's wrong. Those systems are alive and well, and the antis are still building them up. Same problems, different day.
Your votes matter. Your voice matters. All this hard work and dedication you're putting in is really helping to improve our government and our society.
There's no way you'll make real change working within these old, stale systems. It's a trap. There's no out for you in this broken system. Freedom is a facade here. You're stuck in a vicious cycle of oppression. Being a good Democrat ain't gonna help you. You've gotta break the machine.
I'm Bridget Todd, and you're listening to Solution Sessions, changing the world one conversation at a time. Afropunk is a safe place, a blank space to freak out in, to construct a new reality, to live our lives as we see fit, while making sense of the world around us. Here at Afropunk, we have the conversations that matter to us, and these are our solutions. In our previous episode, we dove into some of the ways that voting and running for office could move the needle. But, justifiably, not everyone thinks that method works fast enough, if at all. Especially in a world where we're all trying to figure out exactly what reality is. In 1981, French philosopher Jean Baudrillard wrote Simulacra and Simulation, arguing that media and symbols could create an alternate but fake shared reality. In this world, language becomes a tool for manipulation on a mass scale. It tells us that useless products are actually valuable, and that we should buy our way into a new reality. And it renders the people who make these goods faceless and insignificant. And language, when amplified by those with the biggest megaphones, can have insidious effects.
Don't be so overly dramatic about it, Chuck. You're saying it's a falsehood, and they're giving Sean Spicer, our press secretary, gave alternative facts to that. But the point remains.
Wait a minute. Alternative facts. Four of the five facts he uttered.
Hey, Chuck.
Zeke Miller. Four of the five facts he uttered were just not true. Look, alternative facts are not facts. They're falsehoods.
Alternative facts. This phrase couldn't be a better example of what Baudrillard was warning us against. That language can be perverted, corrupted, used to build walls, and fence off reality.
I get up this morning, I turn on one of the networks, and they show an empty field.
Photographs of the inaugural proceedings were intentionally framed in a way to minimize the enormous support that had gathered on the National Mall.
I have no choice. You know that. Gene, you're fired.
Yes, we now live in a world of alternative facts, with a president who denies things that we all saw happen with our own eyes. And when that happens, we have to question everything.
The first time I voted, it was the Bush-Gore election of 2000. And a bunch of us had this kind of party, and I remember they announced that Al Gore was the next president of the United States, and we all started celebrating. This was in the dorms at Georgia State. And then we turned around, and then Bush was up there as the president of the United States.
That's Franklin James Fisher. Franklin is in a punk band called Algiers. He can pinpoint the very moment the veil of our democracy was lifted, the moment he became disenchanted with electoral politics, sitting in his dorm room at Georgia State, watching George Bush be elected in November 2000.
Florida goes for Al Gore. Now, folks, the equation changes. CBS News estimates when all the votes are in and counted, the Sunshine State will have plenty of sunshine for Al Gore.
Our correspondent, Corey Oliver, asked him about it at the Atlanta Solution Sessions.
That was the very first piece in a long, you know, from then for me in my active political engagement, from then up until now, of a very clear and explanatory sort of picture of why I no longer place any faith whatsoever in the American electoral process. And you trace that to when the American public, after on what were presented as very clearly two false pretenses for two wars, they decided to legitimately elect George Bush for his second term. And then you get this supposed post-racial society with Obama. I mean, it leads all the way up into when, in the primaries for this past election, when Trump won. And I was telling all of my friends who were supposed to Democrats or socialists or whatever else, your alarm bell should be ringing right now.
If I had to describe Frank's take on politics in one word, it would be skeptical. He's skeptical of the two-party system, skeptical that either political party has the best interests of marginalized people at heart, and skeptical of their ability to have an actual impact, including former President Obama. He questions the narrative that 8 years under Obama created meaningful political change.
I liked Obama because he was a brother that gave a lot of racist old white men, you know, heart palpitations. Because he had a brother in the White House and he was smooth, but he was still the president of the United States. Did I ever think for a second he was really going to precipitate change? No. You know, he fought for a couple of things that everywhere else in the so-called developed world are foregone conclusions. Healthcare. Yeah, he proposed accessible healthcare for the general population. And somehow that's the biggest controversy that you could ignite in American political discourse. It speaks to the absurdity of the climate here.
I remember when Obama was elected, everyone saying, Martin King's dream is fulfilled. We have finally arrived. Do you think that Obama's election fulfilled King's dream anyway?
No.
I don't think so. I don't think so at all.
I think, because at the very end of his life, MLK was turning towards very more fundamentally social issues. He was organizing the March Against Poverty on Washington, and at that point, they were like, well, you gotta go. You know what I'm saying? I think he was realizing that what he'd done, and he did a hell of a lot. I would never undermine what he did. But I think he got to the point where he was starting to realize that what he'd done was starting to reach its conclusion. He couldn't really go any further. And he started to realize that what he was really addressing and attacking was a systemic issue. And it was a systemic issue because it was an offshoot of capitalist problems.
We'll be back with more Solution Sessions after this quick break.
I think it's a pretty common sentiment among a lot of Black folks that we were supposed to be very, very excited about the election of Barack Obama, and it was exciting, but then maybe looking at actual progress and feeling a little bit empty.
Yeah, I think that Obama's election was a huge opportunity for us not to be disappointed like we often, and might I say usually, are when it comes to politicians. I don't know if I'm going too far there. But yeah, there was that feeling of being disappointed afterward for a lot of people because there were high expectations of what he would do for Black people specifically while he was in office. And those expectations were not met, to say the least.
That's true. But don't you still get a pang of excitement or pride when you see a Black grandma with a Barack Obama t-shirt or tote bag? Or no?
I do love those airbrushed t-shirts.
Of course.
There's like a huge wall in somewhere in South Carolina, like Columbia or something, with like his painting on it. And every time I go by it, I'm like, I feel good. Like, it feels good. And I think that that's a good thing for Black people to have. But that doesn't mean that we can't also be critical of the things that he actually did. I think that he even said that, you know, I can't just cater to Black people.
And that's actually exactly what you talked to Professor Shayla Nunley about.
Yeah, so I asked her about that whole sentiment of Obama not living up to expectations, and she had a lot to say about it.
I think it's important to question the extent to which the Obama administration was responsive to Black people's needs. And that's in part because if any other time in American history, when would the opportunity be for Black people to have the influence that they did at the highest office in the land by way of the presidency than with what we witnessed with the election of President Obama as the nation's first Black president?
That's Shayla Nunley, a professor at the University of Connecticut and author of the book Trust in Black America, Race, Discrimination, and Politics. And I'm your co-host, Eve Jeffcoat. When I asked Professor Nunley about the post-Obama era sentiment that the president didn't live up to expectations or do enough for Black people, She recognized that just being a Black Democrat in office isn't good enough. We need substantive representation, she said, not just descriptive representation by way of Barack Obama being Black. We still have to be critical of Black politicians' work, and we have to keep asking questions. Now that they have a seat at the table, what are they bringing to it? How are they improving Black lives? But for people like Franklin, who put little to no stock in American democracy, the ineffectiveness of Black politicians isn't the only problem with the system. Of course, politicians can't be our saviors. The real issue is the American political system was built to see us fail. And these politicians are attempting to patch and rig a machine whose goal has always been to oppress us. America's history is one full of racial terrorism and Black murder that was mandated by the government. Time and again, the government has proven that Black lives are not a priority, and it feels like a ceaseless battle.
So it is a matter of acknowledgement of this history, but also what that means for the attitudes and feelings of people who have been disparaged over time, and that this is something that should not be left out textbooks or should not be something that people learn in higher education, but that it is American history that if we were to know, we can try to make sure that it does not happen again.
From slavery to the Plessy versus Ferguson decision that upheld racial segregation laws to Jim Crow, it's easy to trace the history of the institutional restrictions placed on Black people. Take the Tuskegee syphilis experiment, where the U.S. Public Health Service studied poor Black men who had syphilis for decades, but never told them they had the infection or gave them the known treatment. It set the stage, Nunnally said, for Black Americans to feel skeptical toward society and government at all levels.
Men who were poor and African American, without resources and with few alternatives, they believed they had found hope when they were offered free medical care by the United States Public Health Service. They were betrayed. Medical people are supposed to help when we need care. But even once a cure was discovered, they were denied help and they were lied to by their government.
The line of thought for political skeptics is pretty simple, actually. The government consistently proves it doesn't care about Black people, so some Black folks want no part in politics. What kind of emotional toll would you say that years of systemic mistreatment by the government has taken on the Black community in America?
I think the toll has been distrust in the political system. And it is a distrust that is longstanding, such that we have seen Black Americans be one of the most distrusting racial and ethnic groups over time, right? And that distrust is such that it could affect whether or not Black people decide that they become politically active in certain ways.
And that distrust lives on because the government continues to sponsor discrimination based on skin color. Professor Nunnally and I spoke about the low Black voter turnout in the 2016 presidential election and what role distrust in the candidates and the political system may have played in that. But the 2016 election showed just how far America is willing to go to further its legacy of prejudice and persecution of the marginalized. Just look at how the Russian government exploited the racial fissures in American public opinion, as Professor Nunnally put it.
Part of that influence that we are continuing to uncover is the use of social media to suppress or in some way create an environment of skepticism among voters. And so, for example, in the USA Today report of over 3,500 Facebook ads that it is believed the Russian government purchased and displayed on Facebook, 25% related to race and policing. And we also found that more than 50% referenced race.
See? It's another example of the simulation. Internet ads, sensationalized media coverage, and childlike rhetoric became the tools for mass manipulation, convincing Americans that a reality TV star was the most valuable candidate. And the government capitalized on America's tensions over race to control the election's outcome. It manufactured an America that needed to be made great again by a racist, sexist, xenophobic caricature. In uncovering evidence of Russian meddling, we expose the workings of the machine. But even though we've exposed these machinations, the machine is still grinding along.
No collusion, no collusion. No collusion, no collusion.
No collusion.
No collusion, absolutely no collusion.
So you have to wonder, why should Black people believe in a system still going this far to cast out the people already on the margins? What could a few politicians and votes do to throw a wrench in such an unwieldy yet powerful machine?
Yes, the political machine is pretty powerful and fucked, but how do we deal with that? What's a skeptic to do? I wanted to know more about a skeptic like Frank's take, because he's not alone in the way he questions our political views and leaders. Musicians have a long history of standing up against the status quo, and plenty of Black artists have moved beyond their music to challenge social and political norms, whether we've agreed with them or not. James Brown endorsed Richard Nixon and looked up to segregationist Strom Thurmond. Bela Kuti inspired people to fight oppressive governments. Azealia Banks defended 45, though she later denounced him. And Kanye West, once beloved for speaking up about Black issues, has said that he loves Donald Trump and admires the way he defies expectations. And the outspoken Miss Nina Simone? Well, she once said in an interview, "There's no civil rights movement. Everybody's gone." When it comes to political skepticism in the music world, Frank's in good company. So I asked him about it.
What we are interested in as a band is starting a conversation with people. If people want to join the conversation, that's cool. And if they want to argue what we're proposing in conversation, that's cool too. But we're not writing prescriptions for anybody. We're not a political party. We don't have any delusions of being activists either.
Frank had what he calls a normal upbringing and education. He says he spent 12 years being taught things in school, only to spend the rest of his life deconstructing them. So what was your education like when you were young?
I mean, it's like everyone else, you know, you pledge allegiance to the flag, you completely bypass the genocide of the indigenous people. You learn that the presidents were all great men. You barely learn about women at all.
When I was growing up, I was taught in American history books that Africa had no history, and neither did I. That I was a savage, about whom the less said the better, who had been saved by Europe and brought to America. And of course, I believed it. I didn't have much choice. Those are the only books there were.
Most concise way I can put it is that everything that is fed to you is through this lens of American exceptionalism, which is that everything that happened to America is not through the exploitation of free or cheap labor or, you know, people who have been subjugated to a vicious system of capitalism and imperialism, but that America got to be how it was because it was ordained by God. And it doesn't take you very long, particularly if you happen to be a minority, to realize that that's not true.
Was there a moment for you where that crystallized, or was there a time where you thought, wow, I've been fed a lie, we're being fed a lie?
You start to put the pieces together, pieces of the puzzle together, because no system is omnipotent or, you know, infallible. No matter how much they may try to make themselves seem that way. And I think that's one of the good things about culture, is because it exposes sort of those cracks in the foundation of falsehood that, you know, the state kind of tries to represent itself as such.
At Solution Sessions in Atlanta, Frank was especially critical of the state, party politics, and the efficacy of electoral politics to create social change for Black folks.
Malcolm X has a speech called The Ballot or the Bullet from 1964, and he talks about all of this stuff very thoroughly and much more eloquently than I ever would be able to.
Any kind of pussyfooting, that's the government. Any kind of act that's designed to delay or deprive you and me right now of getting full rights, that's the government that's responsible. And any time you find the government involved in a conspiracy to violate the citizenship or the civil rights of a people, then you are wasting your time going to that government expecting redress. Instead, you have to take that government to the world court and accuse it of genocide and all of the other crimes that it is guilty of today.
Now that we have Donald Trump, it's very easy, I think, for people to forget that Michael Brown, Freddie Gray, you know, Sandra Bland, you get the idea. I could go through the whole litany. These atrocities happened while the most powerful, presumably powerful man in the country, in the land, in the world, was a black man. And if people tell you that if you just get out and vote, then you can change things. And not only did these things seem to continue, but they seemed to accelerate on Obama's watch. Something doesn't add up in that equation.
He's right. Obama's administration didn't wave a magic wand and get rid of all discriminatory crime. Even though the murder rate declined most of the years Obama was in the White House, there were many mass shootings, mainly committed at the hands of white men, I might add.
The worst grade school shooting in U.S. history, at least 27 dead, 20 children, 7 adults, including the principal. And the gunman killed himself.
White supremacists were ignited by the fact that a black man was president, and social justice activists pushed back against them, all to the delight of the media, thirsty for sensational stories. The expectation of Obama being a savior for black people collided with the reality of Obama's moderate tendencies and legacy.
An example I continue to think of is that on his first day, I remember posting this on Facebook, his first day, he signed an executive order to close Guantanamo Bay within his first term, and yet we've seen more renditions, we've seen more clamping down on civil liberties, we've seen more unauthorized drone strikes, things like that have concerned me some.
In comparing Obama to MLK, as some do, it's almost as if we've bought into the simulated version of who MLK was. In reality, he was a radical enemy of the state. But as we talked about in the episode on activism, the version of MLK that many Americans deify today is very different from who he actually was, what he actually did, and what he actually stood for. Much like the false nostalgia that Make America Great Again in parts, we reimagined a world where our leaders solved all our problems and were safe and perfect. And when you think about our political landscape, it's no wonder why it can sometimes feel like we're living in an alternate reality, one where everything is a copy of a copy, a knockoff of something that was never real to begin with. You can see it in our president, whose lies about verifiable facts become their own fake reality. And Frank even sees it in the ways that we try to resist, and how it can become a hollow and impotent scream into the wind. The thing about fakes is, no matter how good they are, you can always see the flaws, the little cracks in the facade that show the whole thing is just a knockoff. A theme that came up time and time again in my conversation with Frank were those times when the cracks show, and we're given an opportunity to stop the machine and see reality for what it really is. It can be something as commonplace as Instagram, or, in the wake of resistance to Trump, the way we behave at political demonstrations. It's easy to confuse noise for real progress.
Whenever I'm at a political demonstration in the United States, and people are chanting, "Show me what democracy looks like.
This is what democracy looks like.
And then they do that for about 2 hours, and then they go to brunch. That's not what democracy looks like. Democracy is ugly, and like, democracy is hard won and dangerous.
Hear more Solution Sessions after this break.
While many of us, myself very much included, remember Obama's legacy as one of progressive change, Frank doesn't agree. For Frank, Obama's legacy is one that easily tricks us into thinking things were rosier than they were. The way you might remember things from your youth as happier than they felt than you were actually experiencing them. But Obama's legacy is also a reminder that being a Democrat or a member of any party you align yourself with does not inherently make a politician the best one for your interests. Supporting a party based on a constructed and well-marketed platform is just giving into that simulation. In fact, Franklin says no political party's ideology reflects his. The only thing that feels at all politically representative are those who question the two-party system entirely.
There is not a representational party in American politics that does that, which is why the Democrats are not a viable option for anything that has any substance in my life or in, you know, my peers and contemporaries' ideas. And if you look throughout history at the people who did force these aforementioned changes through activism, through organization, those people did question it.
Even while Frank is clearly critical of establishment party politics, that didn't stop him from voting in the last election, something he says he does not out of expectation for social change, but out of a testament to the hard-won right to vote that our ancestors died for. He also thinks there's hope that voting in local community elections could actually make real change. For as pessimistic as he sometimes sounds, maybe being critical about the world around you is actually a certain kind of optimism, striving to see the world clearly and wondering how it could look if it were better.
If you want to put a label on how we think with regards to American politics, it's optimistic. It's seeking to look beyond the system as it exists in, you know, the duplicitous forms through which it represents itself or tries to represent itself to people, and looking for another way, which is not that difficult. It just takes a little bit of hope and imagination and a little bit of common sense. So you can call it common sense if you want. I don't think it's that complicated.
There's a time when the operation of the machine becomes so odious, makes you so sick at heart, that you can't take part. You can't even passively take part. And you've got to put your bodies upon the gears and upon the wheels, upon the levers, upon all the apparatus, and you've got to make it stop. And you've got to indicate to the people who run it, to the people who own it, that unless you're free, the machine won't be prevented from it at all.
So even if you believe that voting is basically futile, or the two-party system is wasting everyone's time in America, it doesn't mean that you have to check out completely. You can still engage in building a better country and a better world. Franklin suggests reading and having real conversations to reveal false realities that incite true progress. And that's a good start. But once we've exposed the machine and disassembled its cogs, what's next? Where do we go from there? Matthew Kincaid of Overcoming Racism spoke about this at Solution Sessions in Atlanta.
We have to build our own institutions. It's just the reality of this. If you look at the Black Power movement or any sort of movements of solidarity, the reason why these leaders are the first ones to get killed is because all of our power, our collective spending power, our collective intellectual power, we can bank that when we start to build our own institutions. And so if we're expecting the government to make a change, the reality is, you're right, it's against us. So we have to start building institutions. And one of the reasons why it's tough that so many people teaching our kids don't come from our communities, because the civil rights movement isn't done. We have to prepare our kids to continue that battle and that journey, and to teach our kids to start building their own institutions.
If you're Black in America, you live in a country where you've never been valued. Black people were in chains when the Declaration of Independence proclaimed all men were created equal. And we're still the targets of state-sanctioned murder, while white people tell us that racism no longer exists. Because this trauma envelops our history, our very existence in the United States is one of conflict. We've always had to resist, so it's our right to be disenchanted. It's okay to distrust people who've never earned our trust. It's logical to denounce and defy institutions that were built on our backs and simultaneously broke them. But we have to pave a way forward. If we're going to lift the veil, then we have to know what's beyond it.
What's the solution, Bridget?
Read everything you can.
What's the solution, Bridget?
Start a dialogue.
What's the solution, Bridget?
Make your own lanes.
What's the solution, Bridget?
Break the machine.
Next week, we get into the work we can do outside of politics. To do that, we talked to Black Lives Matter co-founder Patrice Cullors about what sparked her advocacy and got her fired up.
You know, that's what I think about every single day when I wake up. Am I changing the material conditions for Black people? Am I making more space and room so that we could be free and we could be freer? And that's the work for all of us to be doing. Whether you're Black, white, Latinx, Asian, Indigenous, we should be thinking about how we're changing the material conditions for those most marginalized.
Afropunk Solution Sessions is a co-production between Afropunk and How Stuff Works. Your hosts are Bridget Todd and Eves Jeffcoat. Executive co-producers are Julie Douglas, Jocelyn Cooper, and Quan Latif Hill. Dylan Fagan is supervising producer and Kathleen Quillian is audio engineer. Many, many thanks to Casey Pegram and Annie Reese for their production and editorial oversight. And many thanks to our on-the-ground Atlanta crew, Ben Boland, Corey Oliver, and Noel Brown. The Underside of Power is performed by Algiers. Connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Afropunk.